Hi, I'm Tim Z. Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is a poet with extraordinary compassion, grace, and talent, Marcelo Hernandez Castillo. And he's been getting some very serious accolades for his new collection of poetry titled Cenzontle. He was recently also featured in People Magazine and PBS NewsHour and media pretty much all across the country. Marcelo is also one of the first DACA recipients, and his writing really reflects some of that experience, along with many other aspects of what it means to be a man of color living in the United States of America today. It's fantastic writing, and I look forward to just jumping right into that interview right now, coming up on Words on a Wire. Marcelo Hernandez Castillo is a poet, essayist, translator, and immigration advocate. He's a professor at Ashland University's Low-Res MFA program, and he's the author of Cenzontle, which was chosen by Brenda Shaughnessy as the winner of the 2017 A. Pulin Jr. Prize that is published by Boa Editions. Marcelo's first chapbook is titled Dulce, and that was chosen by Chris Abani, a fantastic author as well. His memoir, Children of the Land, is forthcoming from HarperCollins in 2020, and that explores ideas of separation from deportation, trauma, and mobility between borders. Marcelo is also instrumental in the Undocu Poets, who have been doing fantastic work across the literary landscape. Marcelo Hernandez Castillo, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
Absolutely. It's a real pleasure and an honor to have you on our show to talk about your fantastic new book, Cenzontle. It's really a stunning collection of poetry. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I know that you had a chapbook before this one, but is this your first full-length collection of poetry? Is that right?
Yeah, this is the first full-length. The chapbook has all of the poems in the chapbook are in Cenzontle.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a best of.
Oh, nice. Very cool.
Yeah. And so the book came out around the same time, but this is the first full-length
book.
That kind of encompasses really everything, given like the broader dimensions, and then also I have space, you know, there's a lot of blank space in there. It's a very sparse book, so it allows for that.
You know, it really does, because the words are rich, and, you know, the language and, you know, some of the narrative and the images that you have in here, the descriptions, it's such a rich book emotionally as well. It's moving. And so I really appreciated that use of white space on the page throughout this book, because it did allow me to really contemplate what you were talking about and really, you know, take my time with it. You know, and I know this is the manuscript that received the A. Pulin Jr. Poetry Prize with BOA. Is that correct?
Yes.
I know that's a prestigious prize, and I think everybody under the sun who is a poet at one point or another might have, you know, submitted for that prize, including me, but back in the day. But, you know, it's a really, just a prestigious prize. How did it feel when you were notified that you received this prize?
Oh, it was a very nerve-wracking weekend, because BOA called me on Friday mid-morning, and I didn't answer, because I was at work. I had a day job then. And I called a number back in Rochester. I was like, hello? They're like, hi, this is BOA. Peter Connors, the publisher, wanted to talk to you. And I said, what is it regarding? He's like, he'll talk to you about it. I was like, can you tell me? He's like, no, he'll tell you. And so I called back, and they said, oh, he went to a dentist appointment. He'll be back on Monday. So I have to wait entire 2 days.
God.
And then I got also like an email saying, you know, hey, let's talk. But that was all. So it was, I had like a feeling, but it was like a mixed feeling in my stomach. and then when I finally did call him on Monday, that's when he told me. It felt really cool, because the Pulin Jr. Prize was one of the prizes that changed their requirements for the Undocu Poets work that we did.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. And, you know, we're going to get into that. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to ask you about that a little bit later, the work you're doing with Undocu Poets, which is important work in the literary landscape. But let's reflect back again on the book itself. I'm going to kind of jump into a heavier mode here. I'm going to shift gears. The description of the book on the back, if I can read just an excerpt from that, it says, these poems explore the emotional fallout of immigration, the illusion of the American dream via the fallacy of the nuclear family, the latent anxieties of living in a queer, brown, undocumented body within a heteronormative marriage, and the ongoing search for belonging. Now, that just that part, and that's just an excerpt from the description. There's so much to unpack just in that part, you know. At the end of the day, after I read your book twice, it really is the best description that absolutely captures the content of the book, because there is an ongoing search or a sense of that throughout the whole book. Tell us a little bit about the content and how you might describe the book for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this, and thank you for pointing that specific sentence out, because I think it carries a little flag of everything else that is in the book, the emotional fallout mm-hmm. of immigration, because, mm-hmm. you know, I like to think, and I'm writing about this right now in essays, that the border doesn't just exist along the southern part of the United States, that mm-hmm. The border exists, you know, everywhere in every major city, in every smaller city, thanks to the overarching surveillance of ICE and the looming presence of that constant presence. But also it exists, the interiority of it, mm-hmm. of how we change our behaviors to negotiate how we move through the world, given being immigrants. And this illusion, you know, of the American dream, you know, it's been theorized before as the American nightmare, mm-hmm. and how it was almost inconceivable to have that dream as immigrants. Yeah. And not only that, but also the American dream in terms of like the nuclear family of husband, wife, two kids, and a dog, you know, in a home. And so I was thinking of also my queer identity, right? Mm-hmm. And how I felt almost like I couldn't own it, or I couldn't mm-hmm. really express it, because I am invested in a heteronormative institution like marriage.
Right.
And so for me, part of the reason why I titled this Ensemble is coming back to this, not knowing how it is that I exist, or not knowing how it is that a you and I, the relationship between the you and an I in terms of the nuclear family, right? What can I call this? What are there other names for what it is that you and I are doing, if it's not a traditional nuclear family, right? So I really criticize the nuclear family, mm-hmm. you know, heavily, because the relationships in the book, specifically with like my mother and my father, was a nuclear family, but there was violence in the nuclear family because of its isolation, because of the secrets mm-hmm. that happen in it, right? You only talk with your partner about this, or this only happens at home, you know, speaking specifically about domestic abuse.
Right.
And so criticizing it for those, and then also, you know, for all the other damages that the nuclear family has done to all of America, the idea of Truman's 50s nuclear family. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, I'm thinking of Catherine Oppie's super famous portrait of her with her shirt off. Mm. And it's a picture of her back, and on her back, somebody carved with a knife, like a house, you know, the little stick figure houses with and a little stick figure couple with a little stick figure child on her back. So it's like all bloody. It's like real. Somebody really did this. And it's at once painful, because a lot of that is denied of you, right? For me, in terms of the heteronormative aspect, but also because of the immigrant aspect, right? Because as much as we try, there's a point that, you know, people who I know who are heavily invested and want to live in like the suburbia, right? Mm-hmm. And have that kind of life, that it doesn't matter that they're never going to actually attain that, right? Because of their brownness, because of their otherness.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of what you addressed right now is, to me, there's a lot of what happens in the shadows of these, you know, these boxes or these labels of, you know, like nuclear family and these types of things. And when I was reading this description, and then when I opened up the book and read it, it dawned on me that on the other side of the shadows of these descriptions is also the light. And I think about that, you know, these kinds of descriptions really open up and make love expansive. You know, they challenge our limited views of what love is and what love could be, and instead make us think outside of that box, you know. And I think love is so expansive that way. And whether you're talking about, you know, the nuclear family, or the, you know, the fallacy of the nuclear family, and whether you're talking about the way one identifies oneself, when you're talking about being undocumented in the United States, I think that your poems challenge our concepts that have been very rigid and are steeped in tradition or conditioning, or, you know, whatever else may bind us. But that's one of the things that I got a lot from the poems in here, is that to me, they really challenged our definitions and also sort of serve to expand our, I think they're testimonies of how love can be expansive, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people who I showed the early manuscript to, it wasn't always titled Sinsontle, but the poem in there titled Sinsontle was always titled Sinsontle. The book itself wasn't always titled Sinsontle. But, you know, the opening lines to the whole book is that because the bird flew before there was a word for flight, years from now, there will be a name for what you and I are doing.
Yes.
So there is language, right? There is language to call these other forms of love, to call these other forms of being. But maybe, you know, we have to get to it. It's not free, right? It's earned.
That's right.
And so for me, it all comes down to really dissolving dichotomies as well, because you have these dichotomies of south of the border, north of the border, because the border itself creates these dichotomies, you know, of physically separating, but also we traffic in dichotomies, you know, queer, straight, undocumented, documented, citizen, non-citizen, male, female, all of these terms, all of these dichotomies make our descriptive lives easier. Yes. I guess they're shortcuts. They're shortcuts that our mind likes to make, right?
Yeah, right. If I may, at that point, I think we would love to hear a poem from you from the collection, if you don't mind.
Yeah. I think I'll start with this one. I just woke up this morning to a review in the San Francisco Chronicle.
Oh, wow.
And they said something that I had never considered before, and I think that's why I want to read this. The poem is Immigration Interview with Jay Leno. They said how the book, there's also like this aspect of the theater of the absurd.
Yeah, right.
In it, because, you know, gender as performance, documentation as performance, all of this as performance, right? Judith Butler, so on and so forth.
Yes.
But I've always thought of it as the Immigration Interview, at least, as a form of knowledge, a phenomenon, phenomenon itself that creates a new body of knowledge, and knowledge being just, you know, text. It creates a new text to be studied. And so the review this morning, what they said is that in the theater of the absurd, you know, it isn't so absurd to think about Jay Leno being represented here as a border agent when we have a president who is a reality TV star.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. And so they made that comparison. And I said, wow. Yeah, that's accurate. So Immigration Interview with Jay Leno. And it's in two voices. I'll try to differentiate.
Okay.
What is your objective? To return all the children hidden behind the street lamps. How long do you plan on staying here? I don't understand the question. I said, how long do you plan on staying here? We would have drowned even without our laughter. Is that really your name? Yes, the clothes on the floor blossomed like the orchards in spring. Have you been here before? There was a man who knew the way. I put his fingers in my mouth when he pointed in the direction of the sun. So tell me, who are you wearing? The woman gave birth in the dark. I thought I felt hands where there were none. Everyone dug a useless hole. Are you alone? North was whichever way the mannequins were pointing. The softest bone was the one that burned the longest. Do you cry at night? Are you alone right now?
If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Words on a Wire, and we are speaking with award-winning poet Marcelo Hernandez Castillo about his new book, Sinsontle, which is out with Boa Editions. Marcelo, that's an excellent poem, and we're going to actually ask you, before we aim towards the end, we're going to ask you to read another poem for us from the collection. But I have a very pressing question for you. How old were you and where were you when poetry first found you?
It was in high school, so I have sophomore year. I guess I didn't know that it was poetry, but I knew that it was language. Because I remember, I think as early as seventh grade. Right. And this is a terrible story because the origin of my, you know, investment in poetry and language came out of jealousy. And this was because we all wrote like some little story in seventh grade. And then the teacher said, you know, I'm handing back everybody's stories. But there was one that stood out. And I want to read a little bit about it. And the person to stand up. And I kind of like grabbed my chair to stand up. And he read somebody else's name. And I sat down quietly. And he read, because I was really proud of my story.
For sure, for sure. Yeah.
And he read, he was actually my neighbor. My neighbor who was in my class read his story of his brother who had, and this was back in the 80s, my neighbor's brother got shot down by the police in front of his house. And he read the story, and it was just like, and I knew it was, I was in seventh grade. I knew it was, this was a searing story. And I was like, oh my God, that's so good. I want to do that. And so from there on out, you know, I was always like, I was always in honors English, not necessarily for poetry, but because I always wanted to master the language. I always wanted to be better than white people at English, you know, and devastatingly so, I lost many years of, or actually maybe many friendships that I would have had if I wouldn't have been ashamed to speak Spanish in the 90s. Growing up, you know, hiding my status and really not being able to really own that. And I lost a lot of years that I wish I could get back,
but I can't.
That's irreversible. So, so I guess the origin of specifically poetry then happened in high school when I actually took poetry classes and we scanned poetic meter, and we were reading, you know, some of the people who you read in English poetry in high school poetry classes. We were reading William Blake, Shelley, and Keats, right? The Romantics, the English Romantics.
Right.
And we were, he showed us how to scan a line, and it was, it might as well been written in a language completely different, in a completely different script. I did not understand it. It was so confusing to me.
Right.
But that confusion kind of like piqued my interest because everybody around me was drawing the feet to where the feet broke, where the accents were, or knew how to call an iambic pentameter line, knew how to call a trochaic hexameter line.
Yeah.
And I just looked at everybody and said, are you getting this? And they said, yeah. And they were trying to tell me. So I was very, 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 very confused at it. But because of that confusion, I was interested.
That's right. Yeah, it lured you. And, you know, I can't help but hear your baby in the background. And you are a father. Yeah. You are a father, right?
I am.
Right.
I am. That's the strangest thing of all of this is that after working on this book for many, many years, you know, the oldest poem, it wasn't the book as we see it now 10 years ago, but the oldest poem in the book is 10 years old. And, you know, I wrote the book long before this little one came, and a lot of the book deals with, you know, the question of what it means to bring a child in the world, into this world, what it means to, you know, childbirth and child loss, because child loss is something that's always been a thing in my family that we don't ever talk about. Yesterday, actually, I was just talking with my dad about it. I'll mention it in a little bit. But after writing this whole book, questioning if I should ever bring a child, what it means to bring a child into the world, about childbirth, child loss, the book and the baby came at the same time. Like it was accepted for publication, and the baby came at the same, literally like in the same month, in the same month. And so as the book was going into production, you know, copy edits, Julian, my baby, was growing inside Ruby's belly.
Wow.
And he was born late November, early December, so November 30th. And the book's publication date was a few months after.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this. How has or has your view or your intention for poetry changed because after being a father, you know, than it was before you were a father?
I think I was a lot more ambitious in the po-biz before having Julian. I was really ambitious of of writing, you know, as much as I could, and really just being enthralled in it, right? Reading, and I still do that, right? I still do that.
Yeah, sure, sure.
But I think the pace at which I do has changed.
Right.
I wake up, I stay at home taking care of him. My partner, she has the steady 9 to 5.
Right, sure.
And so, you know, I wake up, play with him a little, change him in the morning, I make breakfast, answer a few emails, play with him, and I'll start writing, you know, a few chapters in my next book.
Yeah.
So I think the pace at which I'm doing things has slowed down. And I think he's made me want to read. It's weird because he's made me want to go back to maybe poets who I early on was introduced to, then midway I was told to you know, stop reading that. Let's read all these other younger poets, right? Contemporary. So there was a wave of like 2 or 3 years where I was reading nothing but like first books, just first book after first book, even maybe second books. And now with him and slowing down a little, I went to a poetry festival up in the Sierra Nevada. Mm-hmm. And I took him, and there was a book fair, and I bought like a poet who I didn't know he was a big deal early, and I just picked him up and I liked him, but it was the first time coming back to him, Evgeny Yevtushenko.
And I
bought his complete works, a book of like his complete works.
Wow, that's cool.
And also a book on Valéry, the French, and so. Nice. Yeah, I'm going into it a little bit slower, a little bit more with more.
Yeah,
I guess long-lasting purpose.
I get that. It makes you, or it invites you to re-examine what you thought you already knew. You know, being a father, it invites you to re-examine, including yourself or any of your endeavors, books, things like that. You know, that you had, you re-examine it suddenly with a different perspective.
Right.
You know, before we run out of time, Marcelo, I want to ask you again to actually, I'm going to have you close with a poem. But before we do that, I want you to, can you briefly, because I think this is really important, can you briefly tell us just the work that you've been doing with UndocuPoets?
Yeah, we petitioned for, we saw that there was a problem with eligibility requirements, citizenship eligibility requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the major first book prizes in the country, Javier Zamora Loma, a.k.a. Christopher Soto, and I petitioned. And now it's myself, Janine Joseph, and Esther Lynn, who are behind it. We successfully successfully petition for all of the requirements to be removed from all of the major first book prizes.
Nice.
We established a fellowship partnered through Amazon.
Wow, that's great.
Which gives money to undocumented poets who we select as fellows, so that they can submit to these prizes. And
right.
So now I think our next work is to start thinking about the archive, thinking about the work of undocumented writers as a work to be studied, as you know, almost as a field in and of itself.
Right.
So we're gonna. See about archiving this. So both online and I guess in physical form, that's later on down the road. But at least for now, we want to start thinking about the archive.
Yeah, and that's very important work because if anyone's not familiar with it out there, you know, for the most part, a lot of the larger literary prizes that are out there in the, you know, in this country were requiring that you needed to be a U.S. citizen and that kind of thing. And so they excluded a lot of fantastic writers, such as Marcelo Hernandez Castillo. So it's really, we're really proud of the work that you're doing on behalf of the larger literary community. On that note, Marcelo, would you mind taking us out with a poem?
Sure. I'll read a poem about my father and glamour, because glamour was always denied. It was something that was always denied of me, both because we were poor and because of the limitations of masculinity in the Latino family household. It's called Essay on Synonyms for Tender and a Confession for Sandra Maria Esteves. And there's lines of Lana Del Rey in here. color it all blue. My father and my father's father and his. Marcelo, Marcelo, Marcelo. And all of us in one suitcase that hasn't been opened. I haven't been opened. And I say to my father, I want to be all pink for one day to name each part of me after the names of my mother's lovers, to throw my head back and dance like someone pretty or just hold the shame in my hand. And sometimes this doesn't stop me. My name, a 200-year-old word for please, as in, please let me open the suitcase, as in, please let me play whatever is inside. And sometimes my name talks to me. It says, you ain't sh-. It says, I could send you flowers, but what's the point if they will still be flowers when you get them? It says, even the priests are lonely. It comes to me as one priest confessing to another. Marcelo, I want the red dress and to throw my hair up real beauty queen style. If I'm lonely, put the bright birds back in their cages. Marcelo, I wanted a gun. I'm not ready to be dipped in water like you, like a father. And so I opened the lid and held each flute inside like shattered glass. But there was no song. There was hardly any glitter. And the priest, who is no longer Marcelo, and the flute, which is no longer Marcelo, and the lover who is, I don't know what it means to name a child. When he said my name, I opened his eyes. I played the song. Neither of us knew how it ended. We would have paid anything at all to make it stop. Thank you so much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'd like to thank our guest today, poet Marcelo Hernandez Castillo, who we've been speaking with about his phenomenal new collection of poetry, Senzontle. Go out and get that right now. You will not be disappointed. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. And I'd like to thank our fantastic, magical producer, Lauren Terrazas, in the back there. And I am Tim Hernandez. We'll see you next week, same time, same place, KTEP 88.5 FM.